Caring for our eyes, the latest advances in eye care, and dispelling some myths about our eyes. All of us, if we live long enough, will experience changes with our eyes. The lucky ones among us may only need reading glasses, but many people have more serious problems. For example, according to the American Academy of Ophthalmology, cataracts affect more than 24 million Americans age 40 and older. More than 2 million people have macular degeneration. Millions more have dry eye, eye infections, and other problems. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn how we can all take better care of our eyes. We'll find out about some of the latest treatments for common eye diseases, and we'll answer questions about vision and eye problems. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Your eyes may be the windows to your soul, but they are also vital organs that help you function in everyday life, from driving a car to reading a book to recognizing the faces of friends and family. Today, we're going to learn the latest research and advances in eye care. Joining me in our studio, Dr. Linda Schumacher-Firo. She is president of the Maine Society of Eye Physicians and Surgeons and practices as a comprehensive ophthalmologist in Augusta. Dr. Mark Ballas is also with us. He's an ophthalmologist and founder of the Rett Center of Maine. Dr. Jan Berlin is the medical director of the Low Vision Clinic at the Iris Network. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Dr. Ian Jones. He's an optometrist in private practice in Newport, Maine, and president of the Maine Optometric Association. Thank you all for joining us here. Some good brain power in this room with me, and I'm really impressed. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been having any problems affecting your eyes? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. Dr. Schumacher-Firo, I'd like to start with you. Could you start with a really basic anatomy lesson, simple description of the anatomy of the eye, just to get us oriented to different terms such as cornea and retina?
Sure. So the eyeball will go from the front to the back. The cornea is the front part of the eyeball. It's where a contact lens would sit, and it's a clear window. It's responsible for about two-thirds of the focusing power of your eye. Behind that is an open space that's filled with fluid called the anterior chamber. And behind that is your iris, which is the colored part of your eye. Behind your iris lies your lens. This is what gets cataracts as we get older. And behind the lens is a cavity, again, called the vitreous body. That's a gel, and many people have floaters as they get older, and this is where floaters occur. And lining the back wall of the eye is the retina.
Okay. And what is the purpose of the retina?
The retina is what actually does the seeing. It sends nerve impulses to the brain to allow you to see.
Dr. Ian Jones, can you tell us the difference between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist?
Well, the biggest difference between an optometrist and ophthalmologist is surgery. We have different type of specialists. We have a general surgeon who does cataract surgery. We have glaucoma specialists who treat do surgery with respect to a disease called glaucoma. We have retinal specialists that do surgeries on the retina. Optometrists, there are different types of optometrists, but majority of us diagnose and treat different types of ocular diseases. We fit contact lenses and glasses. So that's really the biggest difference between us.
And an optometrist is where most people start.
Correct. Kind of like a gatekeeper, where a lot of the general public comes in, and then we can determine what needs they need, whether it be they need to go see a glaucoma specialist or a retinal specialist or a general surgeon with respect to cataract surgeries. So we kind of help determine where they need to go.
So I also want – this is Linda Firo. I wanted to add that ophthalmologists are medical doctors. We've all attended medical school and training.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. So Dr. Ballas, I want to ask you about some of the most common problems. Dr. Firo already mentioned cataracts. Mm-hmm. I've been told that if you have cataracts, it's a good sign. It means you've lived long. Is that true? that there's one risk factor in that age. But, you know, cataracts are really common. What do you see most often in your practice?
Well, as a Dr. Firo is actually the cataract expert.
Oh, really?
I'm sort of the back of the eye guy. But cataracts often occur in the elderly, but they can occur at a younger age in patients who have diabetes or in people who have had eye trauma. But I'll turn the rest
well,
of this
and,
one
well,
over
let me
to
ask you, you're a specialist in the retina, correct? And,
yes.
And we're seeing more and more problems than we used to. And is that true?
Well, I think we're seeing patients who have retina problems more and more frequently because in the not-so-distant past, like when I started my training, there were a lot of serious diseases of the retina that really had no successful treatment, such as wet macular degeneration, for example. Back when I was an ophthalmology resident, the only treatment that we had available for patients with wet macular degeneration was thermal laser photocoagulation, and that's a treatment where the doctor actually can cauterize the diseased blood vessels that are growing in the back of the eye and can ooze and bleed and cause severe vision loss. But unfortunately, most patients who have that condition were not candidates for thermal laser due to the location of the diseased blood vessels. And now, with the advent of new medications, anti-VEGF drugs such as Avastin, Lucentis, and Eylea, we're able to treat patients who have this otherwise blinding eye disease and maintain good vision throughout life for most patients.
Okay, and this is one of the new advances we're talking about. How many years since these drugs have been on the market and effective and available to many people?
In 2005 is when Avastin, which is a cancer chemotherapy drug, was first used off-label by retina specialists to treat patients with wet macular degeneration, and that was followed in 2006 with the FDA approval of Lucentis, which is a drug that was specifically approved to be used in the eye for wet AMD. And then a few years later, that was followed by the latest drug that we have called Eylea. And they all are very effective. It's amazing now to see patients that I've been treating for over 10 years who still have good vision. The downside, of course, is patients have to come in every month or two to get an injection. And we know from some of the most recent studies that have been released looking at 7-year data that if the treatments start to fall off, then so does the patient's vision. Mm. So it still is important for patients to be treated regularly. And that's a challenge for patients and a challenge for doctors. And so one of the other big advantages that's sort of in the pipeline right now that's under investigation is a new drug that not only blocks vascular endothelial growth factor, which is what those three drugs all do, there's another growth factor for these abnormal blood vessels growing in the eye called platelet-derived growth factor. And so a new drug is investigating a combination of that, and it appears to be promising.
All right. Well, Dr. Berlin, I want to bring you into the conversation. You specialize in people who are coming to you already with low vision. Are your
right.
Are your patients folks who have been born with low vision, have developed both?
Sure. Probably the biggest concentration of my population are people 70 and older, because macular degeneration mostly is a problem of aging. And to Mark's question earlier, people are living longer, and so we're seeing these problems more simply because we have a larger population of aging people.
And what are you able to do for people who are losing their eyesight? I'm sure many people come to you feeling quite desperate.
Well, they do, and I think there are a number of techniques we use. There are, of course, the very simple and basic old magnifiers you hold in your hand with a light, et cetera. But there are new technologies now that are available to people who have not been able to read for years, and those are called video magnifiers. They are continually evolving, as literally as I run the clinic. We are getting smaller ones, we're getting less expensive ones, because one of the barriers, frankly, for using a video magnifier has been cost, and Medicare does not cover the costs of this kind of a device, which may range anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000. They are not cheap. And so we're seeing now a kind of a third and fourth generation video magnifier that's a little bit smaller and also much less expensive, which becomes more accessible. Now, I can give you a number of cases, but the one I remember most is a woman who was a minister. It came to me about 8 months ago, and she had not been able to read for 2 years. She taught French and she wasn't able to teach French. We found a device that we call a 3-in-1 video magnifier, which we sat her down in front of this, and she said, "Oh my, I can read for the first time." It was really an amazing moment for this woman. She bought one of these devices and came back for training, of course, and she's back teaching, and she's reading, and she's doing the things that she wanted to do.
Do you think there are many people out there that don't even realize what's available to them if they haven't come to someone like you?
I think you're right. And there's a good reason for that. When I was in practice in ophthalmology, like Linda and Mark, I didn't have time for low vision therapies, number one. Number two, it's not terribly cost effective in a private practice. But number three, you need a lot of equipment. We have a lot of equipment at Iris Network. Fortunately, the board has allowed us to purchase a host of devices that we have available in what I call the playroom. Basically, we can bring people in and kind of demonstrate after evaluation what they really need.
Mm. Ian, I want to turn to you. What is advised for folks? At what age should we start having our eyes examined? And then how often in our life should we have our eyes examined? I believe that many people, and I count myself into this camp, don't see somebody like you until they notice that something isn't like it used to be.
Yeah. Well, what the American Optometric Association recommends is for the first eye exam to be done at around 6 months of age. Why is that, people ask? Well, especially if you have a family history of we call strabismus or lazy eye, eye turn. We like to catch that as soon as we can so we can treat it, you know, whether a lot of times glasses with patching therapy. And then we usually try to see you around the three-year mark. And then before they start school is a great time for us to get in around 5 or 6 years of age so we can kind of look at their eyes and determine, especially when they're starting school and going to learn how to read, it's really a good time for them to make sure that they have the 100% visual acuity that is needed to do those type of tasks. From there, we usually do it every 2 years till you hit about 65, and then we try to do it every year after that.
So you recommend every 2 years. You don't recommend waiting till you're 45 years old and all of a sudden can't read the newspaper like you used to.
That's usually the case. People come in at that point and say, "I don't know what happened, but I can't read all of a sudden." And, you know, this is my first time I've ever had my eyes checked. So that usually is the first thing that gets people in. And with the advent of all these electronics, we're seeing people earlier and earlier with those type of problems.
You know what's amazing to me is that seeing a little baby with glasses, I don't think I completely understand that. How can you tell that a baby who can't verbally communicate with you has eye issues, and how do you know how to fix them?
Well, you know, like you're correct. A lot of things are subjective testing, but we have the ability, and there's this instrument called a retinoscope that we can use, which shows us a light reflex of the eye. And from there, we can actually determine an infant's actual prescription. Using different other types of devices, we can determine whether they have, like I said, what we're looking for when they're an infant is more their eye turn, is there's a different prescription between both eyes. Do they have an eye turn, one that kind of turns in or turns out? And from there, we can determine whether treatment is needed, like I said, whether it be glasses or patching therapy.
How long has that been? Have you been able to do that, really tell how what's needed for a very small baby?
Oh, we've been able to do this for long periods of time.
This is not a new thing. Oh, my gosh. Change the conversation and ask you, Dr. Firo, what are you most excited about?
I'm looking forward to new treatments for dry eye, which is not a very exciting topic, but one that's extremely common and is bothersome to a whole lot of people, particularly women in the perimenopausal age range and increasing as you get older.
Are there new treatments for dry eye?
Yes, there are. There's a host of different treatments coming out. There's a new drug that's going to be available. Right now, we only have one prescription medication. That's called Restasis, and it's used twice a day for people that have problems with evaporative dry eye, where they don't make enough tears. There's a new drug that's going to be available this fall called Xiidra that works by a different mechanism that will hopefully be helpful as well. And then there are all kinds of different interventions and treatments that we can use to try and alleviate dry eyes, aside from just using artificial teardrops that you buy over the counter in the drugstore.
I was looking through the list of things that can go wrong with your eyes, common problems, more than 50 on the list. Amazing. And I think a lot of people, maybe somebody who's suffering from dry eye or somebody who's suffering from allergies, might not come see a doctor, might think, well, this is a nuisance, but does it rise to the level that I need to come see a doctor? Do you have guidance in terms of at what point should I call and come in?
So a lot of these patients, especially with allergies, will go to their primary care doctor. And often the primary care doctor will be the one who prescribes a medication for them. They may give them an oral medication. Sometimes they'll give them an eye drop to treat it. And if it's not effective, they'll often refer the patient over to see someone like me. In my own office, I have my technicians screen every patient who comes in to see me to discover whether they have problems with allergies or they have complaints about dry eye that they may not have mentioned unless we had asked.
All right. Dr. Ballas, I've read that with the rise in diabetes, there's a real rise in eye problems that are related to diabetes. Are you seeing a lot of that? And can you explain what the connection is?
That is true. The patients who have diabetes are at risk for developing eye disease, and the high blood sugar levels in diabetes damages the vessel wall of blood vessels throughout the body, and including the blood vessels in the retina. And that can cause oozing and bleeding from those vessels inside the eye, which can cause a decrease in vision from one of two major causes. One's called diabetic macular edema, where there's swelling in the macula, and the other is from proliferative diabetic retinopathy, where there's a proliferation of diseased blood vessels growing in the eye, which can then hemorrhage and cause severe vision loss. And again, this is another area which has seen just amazing advances in treatment, where in the past we just were able to use lasers to cauterize those bleeding vessels, and now we have a whole host of new medications that are probably much more effective at preventing vision loss and improving vision. And just to, you know, to mention diabetes, I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting parts of being an ophthalmologist and a retina specialist is the ability to not only restore people's vision or keep them from losing vision, but also to help recognize and treat or diagnose systemic medical diseases. So other than high blood pressure, diabetes, by examining the eye, you can recognize other things like autoimmune diseases, cancers, systemic infections. There's really a huge host of different diseases that the ophthalmologist may actually be the first person to diagnose by examining the patient's eye. So the windows are, or the eye is the window to the soul. And also
and why is that? By examining, as you were talking about diabetes, the blood vessel, and what are, give us some other examples of how the eye may show that someone has cancer, for example.
Right. Well, sometimes we'll see patients who come into the office and their first presenting symptom of undiagnosed cancer is they're developing some visual blurring, and they may have a metastasis to the eye. The tissue layer behind the retina is called the choroid. It's one of the most vascular layers in the body. And sometimes metastatic tumors will metastasize to the choroid. And because the eye is such a precise organ, the tumor can be very small, less than a millimeter in size, but it would start to cause vision symptoms. And if that small metastasis was somewhere else in the body, it would never even be noticed. But in the eye, it is something that can be noticed. And because the eye is transparent, it's really the only place in the body where a doctor can look directly at blood vessels in the living patient under high magnification. And so that gives you an idea about other systemic diseases that may cause inflammation of blood vessels in the eye.
So don't ignore your eyes.
Don't ignore your eyes. That's really
good. We do have to take our first break. Talking about eye care and advances in eye health. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Federation of Farmers Markets. Maine has farmers markets every day of the week. Locate one near you at mainefarmersmarkets.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rukmini Kalamaki, who covers ISIS and Al-Qaeda for the New York Times. She'll tell us what she learned from a German man who joined ISIS and trained in Syria before becoming disillusioned. And we'll talk about interviewing women who had been kept by ISIS as sex slaves and how ISIS justified it. Join us.
I intend starting even before. Tune into Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. One of our main public classical over-the-air FM stations is off the air, WFYB Freiburg, 91.5 FM. It's in need of parts and repair, and we're working on it as quickly as possible. Please note, it may be off the air till the end of this week. We do apologize for the inconvenience. We are working, again, as quickly as possible to get it back up and running. Maine Public Classical can also be streamed online at mpbn.net. You can hear it statewide on the HD2 channel of our Maine Public Radio frequencies. It's also available over the air in Portland at 104.1, in Waterville 99.7, and in Bangor at 106.1.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Keeping Your Eyes and Your Vision Strong. With me in our studio, Mark Ballas with the Retina Center of Maine, Linda Schumacher-Firo in private practice in Augusta, and Dr. Jan Berlin with the Vision Clinic at the Iris Network. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Ian Jones, an optometrist practicing in Newport. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Ian, I'm wondering about just basic care. I have been told all my life I have blue eyes, to wear sunglasses when it's bright outside, when I'm outside in the snow. Is that true? Is it very, very important to wear sunglasses? And if so, what kind?
Well, we do. I mean, that's one topic I always have when I have patients come in. I don't just ask them to bring their glasses in. I say, can you bring your sunglasses in? And the first thing they'll say, sunglasses. Do I have to wear sunglasses? And yes, we want to cut down the amount of ultraviolet light. We want sunglasses that are 100% UVA and UVB protection. It's the sun that can long-term can lead to issues like cataracts and can affect things like macular degeneration. So when a patient does come in, it is important to for us to have that conversation. And it is interesting how many do not wear sunglasses.
What other advice is there for folks? What else, Linda, should we be doing that maybe many people aren't doing?
So I want to add one thing to the sunglasses issue. Another big issue is that people get skin cancers very frequently around the eyes, and wearing those protective sunglasses will reduce the incidence of developing skin cancers around the eye.
So I've read that the big movie star type sunglasses are what we really all should be wearing, right?
That and a hat.
That and a hat. Yeah. Okay. So, well, I'll go shopping. And they don't necessarily need to be really expensive sunglasses, right?
That's correct. They just need to be able to block that ultraviolet light.
Okay. Do either of you have advice, things that people should be doing to care for their eyes that they don't know about? Sunglasses is it?
good nutrition is very important for your eyes. So we know in patients who have macular degeneration, if you have a diet that's rich in green leafy vegetables and fish, that helps reduce your risk of going from the dry form to the wet form of macular degeneration. And we also know that smoking is bad for the eyes. And maybe that doesn't make much sense, but it's been statistically shown that people who are smokers have worse diabetic eye disease and worse macular degeneration. So there's one more reason to stop smoking.
Mark,
and for people with dry eyes too, with dry eyes, we always recommend omega-3s with DHA and EPA. We have found that also helps with respect to helping with the inflammation that leads to dry eyes.
If you're just joining us after Hillary Clinton's speech, this is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We have some really great brain power with us to talk about eye health and advances in eye care. If you have questions about your eyes, taking care of your eyes, about your children's or maybe your parents' or grandparents' vision, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Berlin, you were going to say eat healthy?
Yes, that, and also just comment a little bit on macular degeneration. Many people who come to the clinic ask me, is this hereditary? They're concerned about their children, and they're concerned about their relatives. And the answer is yes, it is hereditary. It isn't one of those 100% things, but it certainly plays a significant role in patients who get macular degeneration. And the other thing I would amplify from what Mark said is smoking is a significant risk factor in macular degeneration. So if there's one thing you can do in addition to all the other positive benefits, it would be stop smoking.
Okay. In the field of dentistry, we often will hear that Maine residents go without care due to lack of access. Is that an issue in Maine? And I'll ask you this, Ian. Is that an issue in Maine for folks who don't have enough access to optometrists like you?
Yeah, we have seen that as an issue in the state. Luckily, we do have optometrists in a lot of areas around the state, but there is an access issue, and that has been a problem ongoing.
And okay, and is there a way for people to get the eye care they need if they can't afford it? Are there programs?
There are programs. For example, like in our area, we have the Lions Club that helps out a lot for patients that, if they have insurance, for example, like main care that may not cover the glasses part of it, they will help out with the cost. We just get that set up for them, and they've been a great help with a lot of our patients with respect to being able to be seen but not be able to get the glasses to help them.
Okay. Our number – oh, go ahead.
So I wanted to mention that Eye Care America program, which is through the American Academy of Ophthalmology, which is a service organization that allows eligible people to receive an eye exam and eye care for a year free of charge from participating ophthalmologists.
Eye Care America?
Yes.
Okay, we'll find something and put it on our MPBN Main Calling Facebook page. I was going to say our number, 1-800-399-3566. And we're going to go to Margie, who's calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie. Go ahead.
He talks about dry eye. And even if you haven't got a cold, I know someone that has a wet eye all the time. Their eye's running, the left eye is running all the time. What would be the cause of that?
Go ahead, Dr. Berlin.
Well, there are a number of causes. Now, of course, one of them could be that there's some allergic problem with the eye, as Linda has commented earlier. Another issue is actually partial obstruction of the nasal lacrimal duct that drains the eye. This is an area that I worked with in my prior life before retiring from surgical practice.
Oh.
And in that arena, you can have an obstruction or even stones, believe it or not, like gallbladder stones. You can have stones in your lacrimal sac. And so the ophthalmologist needs to work you up for that tearing to be sure there isn't an obstruction, in addition to investigating for allergies.
Wow. Okay.
I'd like to explain a little bit about dry eye. So think of your eye as having two tearing systems. You have a sprinkler and you have a fire hose. So the sprinkler is on all the time, and every time you blink, it distributes your tears across your eyeball. You have a second system that's like a fire hose that turns on when you become emotional or you get something in your eye and you get a sudden gush of tears. If something is wrong with your sprinkler system, the only thing you have left is that fire hose. And so you will get intermittently these gushes of tears, and it's still dry eyes even though you're getting a lot of tearing.
Is this something that's fairly easily treated?
There are different treatments for it. It can be a little bit frustrating, which is why I'm looking forward to having a new therapy.
Okay.
Go ahead. The other thing that I frequently used in practice was you can put a little teeny plug in the tear duct that drains the tears away. And that will impair or certainly slow down tears leaving the eye for someone with dry eyes. So there is a way to increase a bit the tear remaining in your eye.
I want to ask you all if there are any basic controversies in eye care. And I'm reminded of this past week, the debate over flossing that's happening in the dental world and how the New York Times article, "Is Flossing Necessary?" has taken on a life of its own. Many dental groups, including here in Maine, have come back and said, yes, please continue to floss. Is there anything like that in the eye world, things that people are going back and forth about whether this basic care is necessary? No? Okay.
Not really.
Well, what about myths? What myths are out there? What do you all hear that you just shake your head and would like to dispel right here and now on public radio?
I get this question a lot, usually from parents when they bring their children in. They say, if I put my child in glasses, won't it make their eyes worse? And my question to them is, well, your children are growing. Do you not give them shoes because their feet are going to get bigger?
So people feel as though the glasses will affect the development of the eye.
And it's not true.
It's not true.
It is not true.
What about you, Ian? Do you hear any myths?
Yeah. That I could say that's exactly what I was going to use too. people do, yeah. The first thing they always ask too is should I wear these glasses or I don't wear my glasses because I think it's going to make me more dependent on them, and that is completely incorrect.
What about the opposite though? If I don't wear my glasses, will my eyes worsen at a greater rate than if I do?
No, they will not worsen. Of course, you're not going to be able to see as well. People go, why am I wearing my glasses? Why do I put my glasses on? I can see. That's why, because when you put them on, you can see. And without them, of course, you can't. So it's important for you to wear them.
I've asked the others in the studio here with me, Ian, about advances they're most excited about. What about you from your perspective? Is it the advances in contact lenses or are there other advances you're even more excited about than that?
Yeah, one of our big advancements we have with respect to contact lenses, a lot of patients, when they hit that 45 range and are having trouble seeing up close, think that they can't wear contacts anymore. Technology keeps adapting to the point where we have these different contact lenses now that we call multifocals, which have give you the ability to see up close and far away with these contacts. And we have them in disposables where you can get them for a day where you put them in and throw away at the end of the day. So the comfort's good with them. The vision is clear. So it is interesting when we have a lot of patients coming in complaining that they can't wear or they're not wearing the contacts anymore because they can't read and they don't realize that we have this type of technology where we can keep them in it long term.
Dr. Berlin, I realize one of the things we haven't talked about yet is glaucoma. What is glaucoma and how many people does it treat? Does it affect?
Right. Well, glaucoma is basically a process whereby, for whatever reason, there's an increase in the pressure within the eye. And that brings us back to kind of a basic discussion. When Linda was speaking earlier about anatomy of the eye, she talked about the fluid in the front part of the eye behind the cornea. That fluid is made back around the lens in a part of the iris anatomy. And that fluid drains out of the eye through a little drain, literally, that circles around the eye just behind the cornea. If there's some problem with that drain, if you will, then the pressure increases. When the pressure increases, the eye is not expandable. The only piece of the eye that really can expand is the nerve at the back. And increased pressure pushes on that nerve, and it tends to push it backwards and hollow it out, but at the same time kills off nerve fibers. That causes loss of vision, usually in your periphery of your eye. So the big thing that all of us are doing is checking intraocular pressure on everybody, because there's an adult form, and in a much less common, there's a childhood form of glaucoma. So these are things that every ophthalmologist needs to recognize.
And this is very common, yes?
Fairly common.
Okay.
I don't have data. Linda, do you have data on the incidence of
Not on the top of my head. It's much more common in Hispanics and in African Americans, less common in Caucasians in general.
Interesting.
But still, we have a significant population who have problems with glaucoma.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's important to bring up that it has no symptoms. That's the thing.
People never.
It's not one of those things that people come in and say they're sitting in our chair because they think they have glaucoma. It's one of the things that are just picked up on these type of routine type of eye exams.
Yeah, and I would amplify. There is a form of glaucoma called acute angle closure, but it's about 5% of the total cases, I think, of patients who have glaucoma. That presents as an acute emergency. The patient presents with a very painful eye.
Was that what you were going to say?
I was going to add something else, that there's a fairly new treatment in the last few years that's done by cataract surgeons for patients who have mild or moderate degrees of glaucoma. At the time of cataract surgery, you can put something in called a stent into the eye that helps to lower the pressure. There's one that was approved by the FDA a few years ago called the iStent, and there's a second one that was just recently approved called CyPass that's going to be available. So now we'll have two, and there are several more in the works for treating people at the time of cataract surgery who have glaucoma to get their pressures down and hopefully relieve them of having to use quite so many eye drops.
So, yeah. But only when there's cataract surgery,
that's
not
correct.
A separate surgery.
That's correct. So this is a glaucoma procedure done by cataract surgeons.
Well, there is another procedure that ophthalmologists can do, and that is a stent. The stent, for most people, you don't know what a stent is, but it's a little drain pipe.
A little drain,
That's really what it is. But there is a procedure for people who have uncontrollable glaucoma who do not need cataract surgery, and many ophthalmologists put a stent in that type of case.
Wow. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about your eyes. Give us a call. We have to take one more break, and we'll be back. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life.
The World brings you stories from the Rio Olympics, and they're not just about the athletes.
People are still very much aware of the political machinations going on in the background. People are still incensed.
But you have the positive side as well, which is how welcoming cariocas are.
Cariocas, the people of Rio, a big part of the story of this year's games. Olympic coverage continues on The World.
That's coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio. Good afternoon to you. It's Thursday, but it's just a regular Thursday, not a Super Thursday. Imagine, were it not a Super Thursday a week ago today, we would still be at it, giving the phone number, taking time away from your programming to remind you of the importance of listener support for public radio. Instead, due to the incredible response a week ago, we've had 6 days of uninterrupted programming. Your response made it possible to keep Maine Public Radio programming loud and clear in the months ahead. And help to keep our pledge drives short. Good for everyone. So again, a super thank you.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest in vision care and eye disease. With me in our studio, Linda Schumacher-Firo. She's an ophthalmologist practicing in Augusta. Dr. Jan Berlin is the medical director of the Low Vision Center of the Iris Network. We've had to say goodbye to Dr. Mark Ballas. He has surgery. He's an ophthalmologist with the Retina Center of Maine. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Ian Jones, an optometrist who practices in Newport. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Going to Felix, calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
Hi. Question. Currently on television, there's this pair of $20 glasses that are adjustable. Best I can figure is there's two sets of lenses that, you know, you can adjust the distance between, however, by whatever means. And I just wondered if they're familiar with this and if they have an opinion on these adjustable glasses. The vision is adjustable, okay?
Okay, Linda Firo, go for it.
So I'm not sure I've seen this particular ad, but I have some experience with a lens system like this that I used several years ago for patients with low vision who were having difficulty seeing screens for their television and for computers. And it has a dial on the side of the glasses where you can, exactly as you said, two lenses where you can adjust the magnification. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you are referring to, but it does work for that particular application.
All right. Well, Felix, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Todd, who's calling from Gardner. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I heard on the radio, I think it was the beginning of the week, about surgically augmenting for sports and, rolling into the whole Russian drug testing thing from the Olympics. And they're saying that PGA athletes were using laser radial keratotomy to adjust their eyes to as much as 28 vision.
Oh, interesting. Have either of you heard about this?
So it is possible for some people to achieve that kind of vision. And yes, ideally, if you're going to have some kind of refractive surgery, you'd want to try and achieve the best vision possible. With the modern technologies with LASIK surgery and using computerized machines and lasers, that's achievable now. Yes.
Yeah, and it's my impression that radio keratotomy is pretty much gone by.
I believe that's hardly ever done now.
Yeah, it's a technique of the past, and it's not really being used now.
Okay.
It's mostly with laser.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, and I've also read about fancy new sunglasses that have you been following this, Ian, the new sunglasses that can almost change the color, make a golf ball pop off of the screen in a different way?
Yeah, it helps out with the contrast. Yes, these glasses are getting very popular now, especially with athletes.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Todd. We have a Facebook post. I've always had very dry eyes. Back in college, they wouldn't even let me give blood because my eyes were so red. They worried I had an illness. My eye doctor said it was, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, blepharitis, and recommended eye drops, heat packs, scrubs, etc. It helped a little, but not much. A few years ago, I stopped eating gluten, and the redness and dry, scratchy symptoms went away within 2 days. Hasn't bothered me since, unless I have a lapse in resolve and enjoy a beer or pastry. Then it comes right back. Does this sound like something you all have seen in patients?
I have no experience with people with a gluten enteropathy having any kind of association with blepharitis, which is an infection of glands of the eyelid.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
It is associated with ocular rosacea, but yeah, I haven't had any issues with gluten.
Hmm. We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. That's Steve here. Hi, guys. I know everybody on the panel very well. I just wanted to add a little bit about your discussion on glaucoma, which is a very serious eye condition. Jan talked about the role of pressure, but it's actually a little more complex. Many people with glaucoma actually have normal pressure or low pressure. And conversely, one can have high pressure and not have glaucoma. So really the only way to really detect glaucoma is by a complete eye exam with measurement of intraocular pressure as being one aspect of the exam, but also having your eyes dilated and having the optic nerves evaluated carefully, because it's an insidious condition, as Ian said, and it can be most of the time is asymptomatic. As far as treatment, I just wanted to add that most people do very well with medication in the form of eye drops. Laser can also be used, and then as Linda talked earlier, there's a surgical option. Well, it's a great discussion, though. I'm enjoying it very much.
Thanks so much for joining the discussion, Steve. Elaine from Maine Calling writes on the Facebook page, I'm extremely nearsighted and have had viscous bits separate from my eye on two occasions, putting me at risk of having a detached retina, according to my doctor. I'm also a lifelong distance runner, and he says running can aggravate this problem. This, needless to say, is extremely disappointing to me. What does your panel say about this?
I would think that the risk would be low unless there's some kind of retinal pathology present.
Okay. Right, I would agree with that. So, and yeah, her ophthalmologist, of course, is going to look in the back of her eye and determine if she has any holes or any breaks or tears in the retina. But vitreous detachment is very common. It happens, I mean, virtually, if you're past
almost
70,
to everyone,
if you're
eventually.
Past 70, mm-hmm. you have a vitreous detachment by definition. So it is not an uncommon process. And I'm not sure there's any real good data about a vitreous detachment in terms of at risk for retinal detachment. I mean, clearly, when the vitreous detaches initially, you have to be careful that the patient has not also had a retinal break or tear. And that's, of course, a good reason to be examined thoroughly. But once that acute event is passed, I'm not sure there's any increased risk of retinal detachment beyond that.
Okay. We're going to move on to Camden and Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm 77 years old, and I had, I think it's strabismus, where my eyes crossed. So one of my eyes was the vision in the center of it was reduced. But anyway, I have cataracts. So basically, I have one good functioning eye, and my ophthalmologist is reluctant to do cataract surgery. And I'm curious what your guests would have to say about whether I'm a good candidate for cataract surgery. And I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thanks.
So it sounds like you have what's called amblyopia, where when one eye turns in as a young child, the brain really doesn't like to see two images. And what it will do is shut off the images coming in from that one eye, and that eye will not develop normal vision ever. In this gentleman's case, the eye that doesn't see normally also has a cataract. So the question really is, what's causing the majority of the vision loss? Is it this irreversible process from when he was a child, or is it the cataract? And even if you took the cataract out, the best you could hope for would be getting back to what it was at baseline.
Does that sound right, Tom?
No, I'm concerned about my good eye, which has cataract and needs surgery, and about the risk of the surgery going wrong and losing the vision in the good eye.
Risk of cataract surgery in an otherwise healthy eye is very, very low. And I think if your ophthalmologist is really concerned, you might want to seek a second opinion.
Okay, great.
Good luck, Tom. And let's, since we're on the topic of cataract surgery, why don't you tell us about how it's changed in recent years?
So in recent years, the femtosecond laser, which is an adaptation of the kind of lasers that are used for LASIK surgery, has become available. And you may see that there are signs and advertising about laser-guided cataract surgery that can be done. And it's being done in our state in the last couple of years. So that's one exciting change. Those particular lasers are very good at improving astigmatism. We haven't really talked much about refractive errors, but astigmatism is something that's usually in the cornea and isn't corrected by cataract surgery. So patients with high astigmatism, if you take out their cataract, they're still left with astigmatism and don't see as clearly. But this laser treatment allows relaxation of the cornea and can get rid of at least a moderate degree of the amount of astigmatism. There's an implant that can be put in at the time of cataract surgery called a toric implant that also can reduce astigmatism.
Hmm. And just generally speaking, cataract surgery, so many people are going to be told at some point in their life that they're a good candidate for cataract surgery. And most people are going to be nervous because the idea of surgery on your eye is, I think it's human instinct to feel nervous about that. But you would say that the risk is what?
Less,
you said very low below,
very low.
But characterize how low.
Less than 1 in 1,000 chance of a serious complication.
And I know it's very quick now, not I mean, just 10 minutes of surgery.
10 or 15 minutes for the surgery itself.
Amazing. We're going to go to Sal, who's calling from Noble. Hi, Sal. Go ahead. Sal, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to revisit the question earlier that the caller had about whether, you know, not wearing glasses can make your eyes worse or whatever. Because I do realize I have an astigmatism. You were just mentioning, or your guest was just mentioning astigmatism. Can you ask the guest to please speak to, you know, whether the use of glasses would help or not affect, you know, the improvement of an astigmatism? Because when I was younger, it didn't seem to matter if I wore glasses or not, you know. I mean, the older I get, it seems my eyes are getting worse and worse much more rapidly, even with glasses. You know, I get glasses every 2 years now.
So you're wondering whether glasses, the use of glasses or deciding not to use your glasses would affect the rate at which your astigmatism worsens?
Exactly, because earlier they said it wasn't, you know, the gentleman doctor said that it didn't necessarily, you know, make the eyes worse to not wear the glasses.
So, Dr. Jones, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you wearing your glasses not wearing the glasses is not going to make it worse. As time goes on, like Dr. Fear was saying, is a lot of the astigmatism is from our cornea. But as we age, the natural lens in our eye begins to harden. And when it hardens too, it can actually induce some astigmatism too. So some people say, why am I increasing? Why is my astigmatism increasing when I'm aging? It may just be that the lens is changing. You not wearing your glasses did not make that worse. That was going to happen no matter what. So the caller's question, not wearing the glasses, is it making the astigmatism progressively worse? It isn't.
Okay.
Wearing her glasses allows her to see.
Okay, Sal, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Molly in South Portland. Hi, Molly. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks for Maine Calling. It's wonderful. I have a question with regard to dry eye. I have a perfectly functioning sprinkler and fire hose system, but my meibomian glands do not produce the oil. I'm having that treated to try to reactivate their function, and I would like your panel to talk a little bit about how the oil in your eye is what really, in my understanding, keeps the tears there and keeps you from having this miserable experience of dry eye.
So this caller is absolutely correct. There are three layers in the tear film, and the outer layer of the tear film is a fatty layer that's made in glands in the eyelid, which are called the meibomian glands. And this is what she's having a problem with. It's an extremely common problem. It's almost ubiquitous among Caucasians. Almost all of us have some degree of problem with our meibomian glands, and it seems to get worse in some people for various reasons, and it's related to also to a condition called rosacea that affects the skin. And there are different treatments that can be done to improve those glands. There are newer things that are coming out now that are surgical types of procedures to remove tissues along the eyelid and to treat those glands to express the material that's stuck inside the glands that can't get out into the tear film where it belongs. When the fatty layer isn't being produced, the tears that are on the surface of the eye will evaporate away more quickly, and that causes a dry eye sensation.
Okay. Well, Molly, thanks for your call. I think we have time to squeeze in another call, so we're going to go to Steve in Chamberlain. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for this program. A friend of mine was recently diagnosed with an ischemic optic neuropathy in the right eye, and that was about 5 years ago. It hasn't progressed any worse. But the question is, can this person do anything by way of diet or supplements or any other type of treatment medication to stave off the possibility of a further recurrence?
So ischemic optic neuropathy tends to occur once. It's unusual for it to happen again in the same eye. It has occasionally that happens, but it's not a common occurrence. Patients who have this happen in one eye can have it happen in the other eye. And so to try and prevent the vision loss in the second eye, there's an association with this disease with patients having very low blood pressure overnight when they're sleeping and lying down. So that if they can talk with their internist and make sure that they're not taking blood pressure medication before they go to sleep at night, there's also seems to be an association with this disease and sleep apnea. So if that hasn't been assessed, it probably should be.
And certain medicines like erectile dysfunction medicines have been associated with it too, like Cialis or Viagra. So sometimes if patients are on that, we'll see from their primary care doctor if they can be off that medicine.
Well, Steve, thanks for your question. It's going to have to be our last question of the hour. We understand that many of you were not able to get through. We had a kind of an unusual day today with the Hillary Clinton speech, but we hope to invite our guests back in the future to answer more of your questions about eye and eye care. And we will put information on our Facebook page about Eye Care America, about the Iris Network, and anything else that our guests suggest we post on our Facebook page. And I want to thank our guest. Dr. Mark Ballas had to leave just a few minutes ago. He's an ophthalmologist and the founder of the Retina Center of Maine. Dr. Linda Schumacher-Firo is president of the Maine Society of Eye Physicians and Surgeons. She practices as a comprehensive ophthalmologist in Augusta. Dr. Jan Berlin is the medical director of the Low Vision Center of Maine. And Dr. Ian Jones, an optometrist in private practice in Newport and president of the Maine Optometric Association. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Allie Burns answered your calls. And we had additional help from Rich Tozier in Bangor. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Short for questions and answers about your pets. We have a panel of veterinarians addressing the latest issues in pet care. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.